Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. The University of North Dakota offers a Bachelor of Science degree in forensic science, and the program prepares students for careers in forensic science, including crime scene investigation, DNA analysis, and toxicology. With me are a recent graduate of the University of North Dakota. She has a degree in forensic science now, Nicolette Rass. Nicolette, welcome to Main Street.
Hi, thank you.
And also with us is Dr. Lavinia Yanko. She's an assistant professor and director of the forensic science programs at UND. Dr. Yanko, welcome to Main Street.
Good morning.
What I want to do first is understand a definition, if I could, of forensic science. What I think it might be is the application of scientific knowledge to legal problems, especially scientific analysis of physical evidence, like in a crime scene. Is that right?
Perfect.
Well, Nicolette, then I need to ask you first, what sparked your interest in the program?
Yeah, so in my high school, I was fortunate enough to have a forensic science class. So I enrolled, and it was my junior year of high school, and it was so, so interesting. It was a very difficult class, but it pushed me, and it was information I've never seen before in any other classes. And so I decided to major in it and get a degree in it. And University of North Dakota had a program, a four-year program. So, yeah, and it was an amazing time that I had at UND.
So I need to ask you, your capstone project, was it really watching pigs decompose, Nicolette?
Yes, it was awesome. For 4 weeks, we were outside with our little pigs, and we were just spending time with them, watching them decompose, take photos. It was amazing.
What did you learn from it?
So I learned the different stages of decomposition. Once the pig was laid outside, we watched it for 4 weeks. It turned different colors. It grew, like it bloated. So gas grew inside, and there was a lot of insects that came to the body. So we collected those and brought them to our lab. Everything you learn in a textbook, it happened in real life, and it was just super awesome to see that application.
And Dr. Yanko, your research tries to identify biomarkers for the estimation of postmortem interval. In other words, the time a person, or in this case, an animal, may have died. Is it harder to do that in a cold weather climate? Is it different?
Well, we do not have insects most of the time, right? And this is why I'm looking into bacterial dynamics during decomposition, especially during such low temperatures. And I might say that the analyses are still on the way, but the results are promising.
What are the different subfields of forensic science?
So forensic science includes all sciences that you can imagine, right? You have forensic anthropology, forensic DNA, forensic toxicology, and it includes every aspect of science, like biology, chemistry, physics, math, everything that you use. You can use at the crime scene. Each science is very important.
And Nicolette, what, I guess, subfield at this point interests you the most? You were a pre-med student, essentially, hoping to go to medical school, maybe pursue a career in forensic science. What interests you the most about the different subfields of forensic science?
Yeah, so all the fields sound so interesting, but since high school, I have found forensic medicine to be the most interesting. Right now, I work at an autopsy center, and working with bodies and figuring out diseases they have and possibly a cause of death, that is what we'll call forensic pathology. And so it's working with medicine and diseases and figuring out that problem-solving aspect.
We're going to talk about that a little bit later in this episode. Before we go further, Dr. Yanko, what specific skills are essential for someone considering study in the field?
So if we are talking about high school students that are interested in our program, I would say you need to graduate from high school, have a strong interest in biology, chemistry, physics, math, and actually any aspect of science. Be curious, have a strong sense of helping others. I think that's very important. And being interested in being part of a team.
Nicolette, I read where you are interested in this because you're kind of speaking for someone after they have died. Is that a correct description of what interests you in the field?
Yeah, so I like to call it the voice for the dead. So once we have a body at the autopsy center, we are their voice. What happened to them? Why are they now deceased? And I think that's super interesting because we can look at the clues. Are there bruises? Are there stabs? Are there scratches? And then we are their voice to say what happened to them.
Nicola, I need to ask you, and Dr. Yonker, you can talk about this as well. The psychological aspects about what you see, is there a balance there for you? Are they hard to deal with? Is it something you've thought about?
Yeah, I have thought about it. It can be strange doing what I do. But there's so much support out there that if it does get too much, you can always reach out to someone. I don't know. It's just, it's not that you become desensitized. It's just, it's okay, you know, and I don't know. It can definitely be too much for some people, and that's okay. But you try not to be too numb because then you lose your human aspect, you know.
Dr. Yonko, what do you tell your students about that part of what it is they're studying?
So this is why I try to include in my classes as many hands-on activities as possible, including that my students, the seniors, are on call during rare cases with the Forensic Pathology Center. So they are actively participating during autopsies because they just need to be exposed to this complex environment. I would not call it tough necessarily, but you just need to know what you will be exposed to and understand that it's okay to ask for help. And if this is your call, again, I'm really emphasizing the need of helping others. We just need to do our job.
Visiting with Nicolette Rass, she's a recent graduate of the University of North Dakota. Her degree is in forensic science. Her capstone class project was Watching Pigs Decomposed. And Dr. Lavinia Yonko, she is an assistant professor and director of the forensic science program at the University of North Dakota. What about autopsies? What would you like our listeners to know about how they are conducted?
Yes, autopsies are very strange, but they're super fun.
When you say, you've used the word strange twice, Nicolette, what do you mean by that?
It's not a normal thing to see every day. It's not a normal job. People go to 9 to 5, but it's my job, and I think it's a super awesome one. But what we'll do is when we do have a case, we'll get the body back to our autopsy room and we'll do an external examination first. What tattoos or scars do they have that we can ID them if they do come to us identified? Any medical intervention? Yes, and then if there's any bruises or scars that they don't normally have, like this might have happened before they died. We'll definitely make note of that. Once we're done with the external examination, we go inside and we'll look at all the organs, anything suspicious inside, or let's just say you're an alcoholic, your liver will be a different color. It might have a different texture. And so we definitely take notes of everything of that. And yeah, that's basically it. And then we'll sew them back up and then they'll go to a funeral home, and that is all I do at the pathology center.
And how then is a cause of death determined in that process? What makes you understand this is how that person died?
Yeah, so it's not an instant thing, cause of death, boom, we got it. It does take a while because on every case we take toxicology. So we'll take vitreous fluid, which is from your eyes. We'll take blood and we'll take urine. Sometimes we'll take bile from your gallbladder, and we send that all to a lab and we'll run tests on it, maybe drugs, just anything that the doctor might want to know about the body. And so that takes weeks. And then after that, if let's just say there were drugs in the blood, they will add that to their autopsy report. And that totally might be the cause of death. Maybe it was an overdose. So it does take a while, but let's say we got a gunshot case. It's pretty obvious what the cause of death was, but regardless, we still have to cross all our T's, dot our I's, and still do everything as normal.
What can fluid from the eye tell you? We've all heard of blood tests and urine tests, but I've never heard of testing fluid from your eyes.
Yeah, so a couple things. Let's say the body is a diabetic. We can also check their pH levels. We don't do that as often, but it can be done. Then also, I believe it's sodium, or it might be potassium. I could definitely be wrong. But after the body dies, you will see a peak in that chemical, and then it will slowly lower. And if we really needed to determine a time of death, we could use that, but I haven't seen that much at the pathology center.
And have you ever thought when you first saw a deceased person come in that this is how this person died, and then later, that's not the case? Has that happened?
Yes, that happens more often than I want it to. We will, let's say the body came in for some reason, and then we open them up and we see stage 4 lung cancer. We were not expecting that, but you only know once you physically see it. You know, if they never go to the doctor, there's no way of knowing you have cancer.
What determines whether someone has an autopsy? Is it?
Yeah.
Does everyone have one? Or if the cause of death is obvious, people don't have them? Are there religious exceptions? What happens here?
Yeah, so technically anyone could have an autopsy. If one of my family members passed, I could request one. If I'm curious, maybe something genetics, I could definitely request an autopsy. But essentially, it's any traumatic or suspicious death, like a gunshot. That's a very traumatic death. Or a car crash, traumatic death. It might be obvious as to why they died, but it's always a traumatic or suspicious death. Natural deaths, we most likely will not have an autopsy. If they're a really old person, lived in a nursing home, if there's nothing suspicious, it's just a natural death, and that's most likely what the doctor will put on the death certificate. But yeah, with religious concerns, it gets tricky. But if the family opts out of an autopsy, we will respect that. But let's say it was a suspicious or traumatic death, we might have to still do an autopsy. We will work with the families, though. Some families say, please leave the brain alone, and we could accommodate for that. Sometimes they say, please don't cut any hair. Please leave all the hair with the body. We can for sure accommodate, but it gets tricky with religion, but we always try to do our best to accommodate.
With respect to the media and what we've seen on television from watching too much CSI, or something similar, what does the media get wrong about what you do? And I'd be curious from both of you what you think about that.
I have a strong feeling about this. It's so-called the CSI effect. Everybody knows about it, right? The problem with it is that, okay, on one side, we have more and more people interested in forensic science. On the other side, the public and often in the courtroom, is this unrealistic expectation of what we can do and how fast we can achieve it. And then our experiments, or maybe jobs, in this case, what Nicolette is doing, right, may be perceived as, I don't know how to find a better word than like maybe weird. We just need to make sure we explain the science to the best of our knowledge, and so people understand that our experiments are needed. The job that we do is very important, especially the job of a forensic pathologist. So I would say we need to always try to promote or emphasize the importance of science in forensic science.
What's your take, Nicolette?
Yeah, exactly what she was saying. It takes so much more time than they portray on TV shows. I was just thinking right now, like DNA. we could swab some DNA sample at a scene, but then what they don't show is we have to clean that sample, we have to amplify the sample, and then we have to run the sample in a machine. That all takes time. It's hours. And in TV shows, it's like, boom, sample, and then we immediately know who it is. It's definitely not like that.
How has technology changed, even in the last 4 years of your experience with the program, Nicolette and Dr. Yanko? How is it different today than it was just even a few years ago?
Technology is actually advancing all the time, right? And the more it advances, the better we are in interpreting evidence, right? And changes, like if you are asking about forensic medicine, for example, so ultrasound, CT scans, all of these technologies, like the improvement and advancement is only helping us being better forensic scientists and helping in understanding and providing more accurate results.
Nicolette, what have you seen change in your time?
Yeah, so DNA is fairly new thing. We didn't have it 50 plus years ago. And so just having that in mind when we go to a crime scene, let's say we have a fingerprint. We have to decide what we want to do with this print, if that's the only evidence we have. Do we powder it and then lift it, and then we can maybe ID someone's fingerprint in the database? Or do we have to think, okay, I actually want to do a DNA sample on this, and so we would swab it instead. So just knowing our technology options can affect what we do at a crime scene or our order of operations.
Nicolette, have you had to testify in court yet?
Not a real court testimony, but in the FS-400 class, we do a mock scenario, and it was an awesome experience.
What do you think about having to do that in the future, where on one hand, you're speaking for someone who has died. On the other hand, your testimony may really impact somebody who is living. What have you thought about that?
Yeah, it's tricky, but the facts are the facts. If I see something suspicious on a body, I ethically should say exactly what I saw. I don't want to play the game of choosing what I say when I say it. That just does not feel right. And it's a little intimidating being cross-examined by lawyers, and they are trying to find holes in my investigation, you know. But if I know what I'm talking about, if I have the proper training, I don't mind doing it at all.
So, Dr. Yanko, what do you tell students is the career path for them if they choose to study forensic medicine? What careers are they maybe looking at?
I would say the one of a forensic pathologist, and for that they will need to go for a medical degree. They can be an MD or DO degree, and after 4 years of college, they need another 4 years of med school. They also need an apprenticeship in pathology, also known as a residency. And given the fact that forensic pathology is a subspecialty of pathology, they need one additional year of a fellowship in forensic pathology, plus a medical board certification in anatomic pathology and forensic pathology from the American Board of Pathology. It's a lot. I just wanted to make sure everything is complete.
Sure.
You have all information.
And when in medical school would one need to choose that, hey, this is what I want to do? Is it right away, or is it in the third year, in the fourth year?
Yeah, it's not right away. Medical school is awesome about seeing what you like. Do every field. If you want to be a kidney doctor, great. We'll learn about the kidneys for a couple of weeks. A heart doctor, we'll learn about the heart, right? And so medical school is definitely about seeing your interest. What do you find the most interesting? But yes, towards the end, that fourth year is when you'll choose it. You'll have a match and you'll see like what you're interested in and what school or like where you might do your residency.
Tell me about crime scene investigation. First, Nicolette, have you been on an actual crime scene, or do you try to simulate that in your studies?
No, I've never been in a real crime scene. but we do so many mock investigations in a lot of our forensic classes that if I had to go to a real one, I would feel comfortable. In the mock investigations we do in class, there's so much that goes into it that you wouldn't think. But when we do it in real life, we're like, okay, wow, chain of custody is really important. And then taking photographs, but making sure the scene is protected before we just walk in there and maybe contaminate some evidence. So the mock investigations, they really do teach you a lot.
Dr. Yonko, what do you hope your program gives to students? Is it just simply a path to a career, or what are you hoping they take away from your program?
I would say essential skills to have a job in this domain. This is what I'm working for. So more than the academic training, I am trying my best, making sure they will be successful graduate students.
Tell me about your research now, Dr. Yonko. What is it that you plan to do moving forward?
Okay, so first of all, just a really brief explanation of what I'm doing. I'm a forensic entomologist, so I'm dealing with insects and decomposed remains. I am investigating all sorts of insect species to see their dynamics and diversity. And with their help of their diversity and development cycle, we can estimate the PMI, also known as the postmortem interval, or the time elapsed since death and the discovery of the body. And currently, I'm working on an ongoing pig decomposition experiment. I already have 2 winters. That I covered, and I sampled tissue this time for bacterial investigation. And this is my second summer here. And actually next week, Monday, we are going to place another 3 big pigs in the field just to make sure we have a database. This is our starting point, just a database with the insect species, time of appearance, climatic records and everything that is needed so we can use them as reference data for later PMI estimation.
How long have you been at the University of North Dakota, Lavinia?
I would say 1 year and 7 months.
How did you arrive to UND?
So I was a Fulbright researcher at Sam Houston State University in Texas for a couple of months, and then I returned home in Romania. And I was just looking for opportunities that will include research and teaching. And when I've seen this advertisement for the UND position, I said, like, okay, let's go for it. I looked a little bit on AccuWeather just to see the climatic conditions, and I'm like, okay, this is a challenge.
Nicolette, what does your summer have in store for you as we wrap it up today?
Yeah, this summer it's that big medical school application. It's super daunting, but slowly but surely I'll get through it, and then whatever medical schools I apply to, they have secondary applications. And then there's interviews if I get far along, and hopefully an acceptance. So that is my summer, plus just working, because they recommend to not work during medical school. So this is my time to get some money.
Well, Nicolette, best wishes to you and congratulations. Thank you. Nicolette Raz is a graduate of the University of North Dakota. Her degree is in forensic science. And Dr. Lavinia Yonko, she is an assistant professor and director of the forensic science program at the University of North Dakota. To both of you, thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The news now is next.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Our law enforcement and our communities are in the midst of very challenging times.
North Dakota Attorney General Drew Wrigley announced the findings of the state's annual crime report. The information is gathered from state, local, and tribal law enforcement organizations. Wrigley says at a time of rising crime in North Dakota, many agencies are understaffed. He says there's a 10-25% vacancy rate for many of the agencies, and it comes at a time of increasing violent crime.
Violent crime, especially violent crime being committed with firearms, is rising and becoming more and more dangerous all the time here in our state. There's no getting around it. Resisting arrest, fleeing law enforcement is up dramatically. In the last weeks of the legislative session, we had two significant cases of police-involved shootings, people fleeing at over 100 miles an hour right here in this community, and it's not just an anecdote. It's happening all across the state.
Wrigley says inmate recidivism is one area where lawmakers will be asked to toughen up penalties. And with the warm spring weather, more animals are starting to birth and raise their young. The North Dakota Game and Fish Department is asking people to not pick up or touch what appear to be orphaned baby animals. Bill Haas is Assistant Chief of Game and Fish's Wildlife Division. He says whether it is a young fawn, duckling, rabbit, or songbird, it is better to leave it alone.
Certainly get the call quite often from folks asking, you know, what should they do if they find a fawn or maybe some eggs that are left behind or chicks or whatever it might be for different species. And then the answer is just leave it alone. Oftentimes the mom had left and it will come back to them. And even so, it's still best just to let Mother Nature take its course and just leave them alone and leave them in their place. If it's on the road or something, maybe move it a short distance into a safe location, that's okay. But don't bring it home. Leave it in the wild.
Haas says not only is it illegal to take wild animals home, it is also dangerous.
There certainly is disease risk as well with some different critters. There could be different issues with that if you're bitten by them. And so that's something to be concerned about. And then also just the risk, too, for those critters is when you end up handling them, it puts your human scent on them and could increase the likelihood of that mother abandoning their young as well. So just for you and for the best for the wildlife, it's best just to leave them alone, observe them, and just leave it be.
Haas says instances when human intervention is needed is very rare, and it is often better to let nature take its course.
If there are those extreme situations that are really unique that someone has, certainly can give our Game and Fish office a call and get in touch with one of us, and we can walk you through the process of if you have a unique situation that's happening and really just need to know what to do. Give us a call in those situations, and we can help determine what the best course of action would be.
The department is also asking citizens to steer clear of adult wildlife, such as deer or moose, that might wander into urban areas. Crowding stresses animals and can lead to a potentially dangerous situation. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Laughing Sun in Bismarck, Atypical in Minot, Drecker and its new Brewhalla Market in Fargo, just three of the many craft breweries in the state. And Jamestown is now on that list, with Drift Prairie Brewing officially open this week. Special contributor Sabrina Horning takes us to Drift Prairie Brewing, where she found founding members Emma Kleingartner and Kaylin Heller, and the promise of, get this, a flight of Kukin.
This is Sabrina Horning. Today we are at Drift Prairie Brewing in downtown Jamestown, located in the old Jamestown Sun building, which is pretty cool. So we're sitting here with Kaylin Heller, president and founding member of Drift Prairie Brewing, and Emma Kleingartner, another founding member of Drift Prairie Brewing. So How many members are part of your core group here at Prairie, or Drift Prairie Brewing?
Yeah, that's a great question. There is eight founding families that have taken part in being the sort of the collective founding group.
How did Drift Prairie come to be?
I guess I can say for me personally, and I think there was probably some other people that were floating the idea around, but for me it was an idea that I had 4 or 5 years ago. I guess I should probably preface by saying that Emma and I, and really our entire group, we are from the Jamestown area. We love Jamestown. We care about it. We care about our region. We want to see people come together just to support and encourage one another. And I think just being drawn to the idea of creating something in Jamestown that hasn't existed before, or at least hasn't existed for a long time, as I think there was actually a brewery here a long time ago, which is another cool story. But yeah, just wanting to create a place where people can feel comfortable and come and be themselves. And we're wanting to make it a place that people can bring their families. So it'll be children will be welcome. Yeah, so really just a place where people can gather together and have community and interact with one another, have good conversation. So we're excited to get the doors open and get started.
I got
to
hear all about the beer. In founding a brewery, what kind of flavors, I guess maybe flavor isn't the right word, but what kind of varieties of beer do you plan on having?
So I wish our brewer was here because he could speak much more intelligently than I can to that. But I just like good beer. And so Anton, who is our brewer, actually has like a background in chemistry. So he knew the process super well before he actually ever started brewing himself. Right now we have a dark wheat, which is fantastic. We have a summer ale, which is kind of like a summer shandy, if you're familiar with like Leinenkugels. I know there's a lot of requests for a sour. Sours are super popular. A blonde ale. Some other things in the works too.
And then you also stressed that you want it to be a family environment. What kind of non-alcoholic options?
One of our founders is brewing a root beer, or has brewed several batches, and that's been successful and it's delicious. So we're excited about that. We want to do some fun things seasonally, like maybe cold brew teas in the summer, possibly coffee someday, and maybe even kombucha. We've talked about that in the future, but right away, yeah, we plan to have the root beer available and probably a couple of mocktails that the kitchen's been working on putting together. So, like a cocktail, but without the alcohol.
What kind of a response have you gotten from the community? By looking at your Facebook page, it looks like people are really excited.
Yeah, you know, we've been blown away by the support from the community. That's one thing that's so cool about Jamestown and kind of our surrounding areas. Just everybody kind of knows everybody. It's like a one degree of separation. So people will stop me, or they'll stop Emma or any of our other founding members, like when we're at Walmart or wherever we might be at a grocery store, and just say like, hey, when are you guys going to open? I've been seeing like all of the updates. We're super excited. So we're really thrilled to do that. And then to also like partner with other organizations, especially throughout North Dakota, but then just kind of within the region. I'm so excited to build some of those partnerships. And
so how do you like to drink? Like, what kind of beers do you find really exciting, and do you seek out?
I honestly enjoy pretty much any beer, any craft beer that I try. I wouldn't say I have an indiscriminate palate, but I don't know. I just really enjoy most that I try. But what I really like, I guess what really like hits the spot for me would be like a porter or a stout.
I think I would probably agree with that. Probably more so like just growing up on a farm, I've always liked wheat beer. So wheat has been one of my favorites. And then just like sours, kind of like everybody else lately, I've really been getting into that.
Yeah, sours are really interesting beers. Mm-hmm. And there's always so many interesting flavor combinations, that's for sure. Thinking about the name Drift Prairie, how do you come upon a name for a business?
Drift Prairie is actually the name of the kind of the center of the state, the geological region that runs down kind of the middle to middle eastern part of the state, bordered on each side by the Red River Valley on the east and the Missouri Slope, Missouri Plateau on the west. It was something that had come to my mind. I've just always liked the name. It sounds, I don't know, it just sounds neat. It really defines our region, I think, and it was just always stuck with me. It was always in my head because of third grade North Dakota history. That's where I first learned it, and I just always remembered it and put it up there for nomination, and it was the winner.
Can you tell us a little bit about the brewing area? Like how much beer can you brew at a time?
For any beer fanatics out there who might know what we're talking about, that we have a 15-barrel system. And right now we have 3 varieties in the fermenters that are fermenting and getting ready for when we open.
And then in regard to our beer, we actually also have a distribution line that we're going to be opening up probably in a phase 2. So we've got a canning line that we're super excited about and hopefully be able to partner with a bunch of other organizations in North Dakota and then even in the upper Midwest or as far as we can go.
When you're coming up with all the equipment and making your list and like preparing to open the brewery, did you have somebody that was kind of like your brewing Yoda that kind of helped you out and that provided a lot of insight as far as like everything that you would need and, you know, help offer a little bit of guidance?
You know, I think one thing that is so incredible about our team is that each person brings varying gifts and varying talents and experiences to the table. There are some people that are really just had more knowledge of brewing, you know, setting up the brewing process itself. But then there's also just like Emma's background with catering and with cooking. She has that expertise. Some of us have marketing abilities. Some of us have other abilities just working with the community. And so being able to bring all those different talents together has really, I think, just strengthened our team, and it has made things overall just go very smoothly. I mean, we have some hiccups like any upstart is going to, but overall, it's a super healthy, fun team to be a part of.
You guys have kind of a lot of interesting things up your sleeves. I also saw that you guys are going to have a pretty cool menu, that you're going to have food and all that other stuff.
Yeah, so we will have, I guess you'd call it a limited kitchen, different than maybe most kitchens, especially bar or pub type food that's available so far locally. So we're excited to bring something new to the table that way. It'll be mostly fresh and small plates, not necessarily appetizers, but things like a lavash, a couple different sandwiches that we're really excited about that have some just a really great feature to each of them that give them their uniqueness. Charcuterie, that's what we're the most excited about. I don't think anyone else is doing that locally. And that can be easily, you know, made differently to accommodate different dietary needs. And so we're excited about that. And it goes well with beer, and it can be changed up seasonally as well, too. We might even do some dessert charcuterie down the line, which would be fun. A little variety of desserts on a tray.
Emma, you have a background. You mentioned your catering company. Would you be willing to talk a little bit about your experience catering?
I mean, kind of a self-taught cook, and I used to not really want to call myself a chef, so we'll just leave it at that. But I'm a self-taught cook. I had a little bit of experience locally. Worked for a couple caterers, like twice. Two events, like that's it. And that was it. I knew that's what I wanted to do. And so I opened my own company and did that for about 15 years, and then just about 1 year ago sold it to a gal who worked for me since she was very young, and she's done a great job taking it over. I specialized in German-Russian cooking. It wasn't an everyday thing, but it was definitely like a specialty that folks would reach out to me for when they needed it, wanted it. So I retained the cooking part of that business and then opened another just small business after selling the catering part and called it just simply Emma's Kuchen. So I make whole Kuchen. I make Kuchen cups, which is just like the custard and then the fruit or candy, whatever type of filling layered in a cup that you eat with a spoon. Those can be frozen really easily and they can be very easily made gluten-free. So people like that. And they kind of appeal to maybe the younger generation or kids more than the traditional pie shape. I'm also going to be doing mini, like 6-inch Kuchens, and we're calling those cuties. And we also do a mini version of the cup that we call like shooters. And at the brewery, we will have a variety of these products, maybe all of them, maybe not all of them at the same time, but they'll be here exclusively is the plan once we're open. And the most exciting part of that probably is the flight, that we will have a flight like you would get of beer, but of little mini Kuchen shooters.
Emma, you had me at Kuchen flight. So you don't have to tell me everything about your Kuchen recipe, because I know that there's a little bit of like magic to every Kuchen recipe. So was it a recipe that was handed down, or was it a recipe that you kind of tweaked, or can you tell us a little bit?
Sure. So I started loving cooking, I guess, probably this summer. I was like 14, and I pretty much cooked my way through the Stutzman County Homemakers Cookbook, like the movie. There's the Julie and Julia, where she cooks her way through Julia Child's French cookbook. I did that with the Stutzman County Homemakers Cookbook, and of course there are many Kuchen recipes in there. And so, yeah, mine is just kind of the combination of several of those and me changing it and tweaking it to my liking over the years.
I really love that. And I think that there's so much value, you know, as a young person and, you know, taking these traditional recipes and kind of adding your loving personal touch to it and kind of carrying on the tradition to like a whole nother generation of Kuchen eaters.
I share the same sentiment. Like, I think it's great to pass it on. My parents raised me to understand and honor those traditions too. And the food part just kind of came naturally to me. And so it's, I guess, probably my favorite way to help carry on our local heritage.
Well, thank you so much. We're sitting here with Kaylin Heller and Emma Kleingartner at Drift Prairie Brewing. I look forward to sipping on some of your beers in the future.
That was special contributor Sabrina Horning in conversation with founding members of Drift Prairie Brewing, Emma Kleingartner and Kaylin Heller. Still to come on Main Street, Dakota Folklife and Stories with veteran Robert Moore.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. We are coming up on Memorial Day weekend, a day set aside to honor those who gave their lives in battle. Now, of course, we can't hear from people who lost their lives in battle, but we can hear from other people who would understand. Veterans. Today, we share an excerpt from Telltale, Dakota Folklife and Stories. It's a collection of narratives describing the shared personal experiences and lore of life on the North Dakota Plains. They feature interviews with senior citizens, many of whom are in elder care facilities. We hear now from veteran Robert Moore, who served in the Marines, and this is narrated by David Swenson.
As a young man, he received some fatherly advice, which led him to enlist in the Marine Corps, a decision which he never regretted.
I had a friend, Paul Fisher, whose dad was in the Marine Corps. I was going to go in the Army, and I wasn't sure if it was Army or Marines, I wasn't sure. And I went over to Paul's house, and I talked to his dad. His dad convinced me to go in the Marine Corps. He said, this has been emotional for me. You don't stand very straight. You don't know a lot about life, but when, by the time you get out of the Corps, you will. Just, you know, family. He was a good man. He was, and everybody knew it. Everybody knew, you know, somebody you could go talk to if you had a problem. He was a pretty good guy. Not having a father, see. He is pretty much the reason. He told me a lot about boot camp and the training you could get. Sounded good to me, and I'm glad I did. The first thing that I ever heard out of a DI's mouth was, shut your mouth and open your ears, and I'm going to teach you something. And boy, everybody shut up. Everybody shut up to listen to this man. You go through boot camp, and there's two ways to go through. You're either accepted. Then there's the ones where something happens and they kind of keep an eye on you. And that was me. He caught me with my mouth open. And he came to me and he said, you know what? You got other things wrong with you too, and I'm going to fix it. I thought, oh, God, what's this guy talking about? I always stood crooked. I always marched crooked. He'd catch me every time, you know. You're dancing. You're not marching, son. You're dancing. But he was just playing with me a little. We did that with a lot of guys. At the moment, it's kind of scary when he's telling you stuff like this, because they got absolute power over you. You know? So that's, you know, that's how it started. When you go in to take the oath, when you're standing there with all these guys you don't know, you're standing there in front of well-respected officers who you don't know, and you understand from what people have told you that these men had been to war. These were the finest. These men had been to war that are selecting you. And when you come into the office, you're to have respect for these men, you know, because you're not a Marine yet. You're just a kid. I was just a kid. I looked at these men. I thought, you know, my country is safe because of these men. And I want to be like that. That's a pretty proud moment. You take the oath. Swear to defend your country. Boy, they mean it, too. You don't know what's going to happen. So I did 3 months boot camp, took 38 pounds off of me, and I was only 17, and I was pretty big. I lost 38 pounds and standing up straight. About one quarter of the platoon never makes it. There's about 20 guys that don't make it. They get kicked out. Just can't tolerate the training. you're exercising from morning till night. Before breakfast, you're exercising. You're running after breakfast. You run to breakfast. You're running after breakfast. Then you're exercising. Then you're going to classes. And there's more exercise, more running. It's just all day long you're running. And you're doing this. Like, I had blisters the size of acorns on my feet. I mean, I had so many blisters. There ain't nothing you can do. They won't give you a Band-Aid. They ain't going to send you off to the doctor for a few blisters. You just got to tolerate it. Your feet got to get as hard as your mind is getting, or you're not going to make it. And you hear a lot of guys crying about their pain. They don't, they know you're in pain, and they want you in pain because you have to suffer in life to become a man. I really believe that. Or a woman in life, there's just a lot of suffering. We're born in suffering, and we die suffering. And in between, there's a lot of suffering. And in the Marine Corps, they teach you that. And they teach you morality. They teach you to be a good man, be a good Marine, be a good man. Honor your father, your mother, your country. Take care of your family. They teach you all that. That's what they do. They got what's called a guidebook, United States Marine Corps guidebook, and they teach you that book. You got to know that book from top to bottom. You got to know your general orders, all 12 general orders. You got to be able to speak them, all 12 of them. And at any given time, they will test you, and they're long, not easy. They teach you Marine Corps history. And that's what most of the teaching is right there, the history of the United States Marine Corps, when it was founded, all the wars they've been through, all the men who suffered and died. So there's some great, great men that they talked about. You have to be there. You just have to be there to understand it. They teach you right off the bat that there is a spirit of the Corps, and that permeates throughout everything you do. There's spirit that's there that is alive, and we're going to place you in it and teach you about it, and it'll take a hold of you. You'll understand it even more when it does. Nobody can beat up that spirit or take it away. I ran into a young guy. I was on the road hitchhiking around, and I ran into a young kid up in Eugene, Oregon. He was 17 years old. I was in my 20s, and he was very scared. He was homeless. His parents didn't want him. There was a homeless shelter not far from there, and we were in this big field where a lot of homeless guys were. So we sat there until about 3 o'clock in the morning talking. And all I talked to the guy about was how he should go in the service. Don't let this miserable civilian life that you're caught in screw you around. I just had a feeling that I needed to talk this kid into going into the service. We went over, we got up in the morning, and we went over to the mission. We had breakfast, took a shower and everything. And I said, kid, I got to say goodbye to you now. And he thanked me for everything. He said, I promise you I'm going in the service. He said, you've made up my mind. He said, he's going to go over and talk to the GI. He's going to try and get his parents to sign off for him. But he wants to go in the Marine Corps. And I was proud. I was proud of that moment. I don't know if he ever did or not. But that's what I would tell the young guy. I would say, look, if you got nothing going and you want something going, go in the service. And I recommend it to any young person that's out there. It's a life. They give you a life. I'm proud. I'm very proud. I just never get a chance to talk about it. So thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Produced in partnership with the Cheyenne Care Center in Valley City, North Dakota, and Dakota Legacy. This project is produced in part with a grant from the North Dakota Council on the Arts, which receives funding from the North Dakota State Legislature and the National Endowment for the Arts.
Narrator David Swenson owns Makoche Studios in Bismarck, where Telltale is produced. These oral histories are available on our website. Go to prairiepublic.org, click on Listen, and then Podcasts and Digital Series. Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 23rd. Today, we take a look back on the past concerts in Bismarck. Perhaps you will remember some or be surprised at who performed in the capital city. Baritone singer Nelson Eddy appeared in 1934 at the City Auditorium. He was at the start of his Hollywood film career. Coming to Bismarck after a concert in New York City, he asked reporters what his Bismarck audience would like. Eddy's repertoire included works by Johann Sebastian Bach, George Frideric Handel, Hugo Wolf, and other composers. He was accompanied on piano and gave several encores. The audience gave Eddy the heartiest ovation, according to the Bismarck Tribune. In 1942, contralto Marian Anderson appeared at the auditorium, a concert the Tribune called the greatest artistic triumph scored in Bismarck in many years. Her concert came 3 years after her famous performance for 75,000 people from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., after the Daughters of the American Revolution had refused to allow her to sing at D.A.R. Constitution Hall because she was black. Her Bismarck concert for 1,100 people included The Crucifixion, Ave Maria, and Songs My Mother Taught Me. Anderson ended her performance by inviting the audience to sing along for the first verse of the national anthem. After the concert, she signed autographs backstage. On this date in 1975, the Guess Who performed at the Bismarck Civic Center. In a concert preview, the Bismarck Tribune noted the rock band's success with its songs American Woman and These Eyes. But the concert might have been more memorable for the young man later convicted at trial for attempting to incite a riot. He was accused of yelling obscenities at police, refusing to sit down and be quiet, and attempting to strike an officer after police cracked down on the concertgoers who were throwing frisbees. A judge fined the man $150. Artists who performed multiple times in Bismarck include Tammy Wynette, Barbara Mandrell, the Statler Brothers, and Kiss, to name just a few. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. Thank you so much for joining us. Coming up tomorrow, two UND researchers were recently awarded a grant from the U.S. Department of Energy to study the possibility of recovering rare earth elements from North Dakota's lignite coal, and this could lead to major new industry for the state. Nolan Baker from the UND Institute of Energy Studies stops by to discuss. We hope that you'll join us again tomorrow on Main Street.